as I've indicated, the way that I see the epistles of John are that 2nd and 3rd John were written before 1st John. And it's helpful in looking at 1st John to see it through the template of the other books. The long and short of it is that John seems to have been absent from Asia Minor. And as he was absent, he initially indicated that in 2nd John that he wasn't going to go into great detail because he would follow up in person. I suspect that he was delayed, and we're going to look at some of the factors that give reason to think that John's absence from Asia Minor may have been extended. I believe that with that, John then did write 1 John because if he was going to be gone for an extended period of time, he couldn't just wait while there were some problems that were going on. They needed to be dealt with. How does this help us in dealing with 1 John? No one in approaching 2nd or 3rd John gets into the elaborate models of perseverance theology. Yet, when they look at 1 John, they do. But when one relates the outline of 2nd John with that of 1 John, all the major points are dealt with in a very cursory way in 2nd John. My sense is that 1st John is an elaboration going into more detail. But the whole model that people construct on perseverance theology, where people cannot know that they have everlasting life, what a preposterous notion that God would leave people in the dark wondering, am I truly a child of God? Have I really believed the message of life? Or do I have false faith? That whole notion finds much greater difficulty gaining any plausibility when one sees 1 John as deriving out of the outline of 2 John. So with that as background, that's the reason we're going 2 John, then 3 John, then we'll get into 1 John. A reason that I'm wanting to be in the Johannine epistles, of course, is that they are related to the content of the Gospel of John. We will see when we do get into 1 John that John made his readers aware of his gospel and that his gospel is part of the background for 1 John, and I would say also background for 2 John and 3 John. So, with that, we will open up into the book of 3 John. So, my point here is that for verse 1 is that what we have is the salutation. John greets Gaius, whom he loves in truth. 3 John, verse 1. He says, the elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Now, the first thing that I think needs to be said here is that both Peter and John refer to themselves as elders within context of their epistles. And the concept of elder would be similar between elders during the era of the apostles and the era now after the apostles. Remember that in 1 Corinthians, Paul makes it clear that one of the things that was a prerequisite for being an apostle was that the person would have seen physically the resurrected Jesus Christ. We see that even within the commissionings that occur within the book of Acts, the basis for the selection of the replacement for Judas there within the early sections of the book of Acts and so forth, that it was necessary for apostles to have been eyewitnesses of Jesus, in particular that they had seen him resurrected. But beyond that, it would seem that they also were ones that needed to be with him during his earthly ministry. The Gospel of John makes that clear as one looks at the end of John chapter 15, where Jesus says that they are going to carry on the ministry of testifying because they had been with him from the beginning. They had heard his message and so forth. So we do live in an era where no one alive on planet Earth has seen the resurrected Jesus. We do not have any apostles. But the office of elder is something that existed both within the apostolic era and subsequently. It is the primary leadership category that has been established for local churches. And passages like 2 Timothy chapter, or 1 Timothy 5:17 indicate very clearly that there would be a plurality of elders. I'm not going to go into details on that, except I'll give a quick summary. That passage does speak about elders who rule well being considered worthy of double honorarium. Now, there are those that argue that there is only one elder per church and that the elder of the church would be the pastor of the church. That creates an interesting complication in 1 Timothy 5:17. The nature of that complication would be that he sets up the basis for the double honorarium being financial compensation for one's service, the double honorarium being granted or being deemed that elders who rule well are deemed worthy of that. So he then specifies, but especially those who labor in the word and teaching. The way that that works out, if we were to set it out on a 2x2 grid, we would have elders who rule well and who labor in the word and teaching. Obviously, they are ones that Paul is recommending for the double honorarium. We would also, in the lower right quadrant, have those that do not rule well and do not labor in the word and teaching. Clearly, they would not be worthy of a double honorarium. But now the question becomes, what about the two groups in between? What about ones who rule well but do not labor in the word and teaching? Paul says such people are considered worthy of the double honorarium. That would be under the single elder per church model, indicating that ruling well is more important than laboring in the word and teaching. Because the one who labors in the word and teaching but does not rule well is not considered worthy of the double honorarium. That creates a real problem for the single elder per church model. And I have written on that. If anyone is interested, please let me know and I will send a link to the article. On the other hand, under a plurality of elders model, where each church would have more than one elder, but within that plurality of elders model, there would be one of those elders would be particularly responsible for teaching, and therefore would need to carve out time for the preparation of those messages. That is a person who's going to have a harder time making ends meet financially, unless the church is contributing to his financial needs. It does seem that within the New Testament era that most people, other than at certain points, the Apostle Paul, seemed to be necessary for them to work on the side. That would clearly be the case with small local congregations. So, saying that the one elder labors in the word and teaching because he's designated to do that, and others are involved in ruling, but they still have time to go out with standard employment, earn their living, the church is not responsible to the same degree to make sure that they are compensated in the same way as the one who is sacrificing the number of hours he would have available to earn income. Okay, so that's a brief summary of how 1 Timothy 5:17 would support the idea of a plurality of elders. But John is classifying himself, though an apostle, as an elder. He's placing himself at the same level as the elders of the congregation to whom he's writing. It could well be that Ephesus or one of the other seven churches of Revelation would be the ones specifically to which Gaius is connected. John knows this man because John has ministered here in Asia Minor, and Gaius would have been someone that he knew well during his time there, but now John is absent. As I indicate in the notes, this Gaius is probably not the same Gaius that is mentioned in other places in the New Testament. Gaius was a common name, and the people by the name of Gaius that are mentioned in Acts, 1 Corinthians, and Romans were in a different geographic locale than this one. So there is no reason to suppose that it is the same Gaius. What is the destination of the letter? John seems to have ministered in Asia Minor, in western Turkey, the area covered by the seven churches that are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3. So that would indicate the probability that that is where this letter is addressed to. Now let's consider the date. And for this, we're needing to look for a period of time that John would have been absent. The way that this letter is written, it gives indication that John is not present, has not seen Gaius for a period of time. Listen to the tone of this and see whether it sounds as though he is in the immediate vicinity and would see him within a week or two. The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health just as your soul prospered. For I rejoiced greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well, because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such, that we may become fellow workers for the truth. Everything within this has the indication that the period of time of separation has been lengthy. So, with that, we need to set up some of the parameters here. Let's turn back to Galatians chapter 2, verse 9. Galatians being the first book that Paul wrote. He wrote it in the year 49 under the South Galatian model, which I have argued for when we were in when we were studying Galatians. I don't remember when that was, but that's now been a considerable period of time, but this is Paul's first book. Let's start setting up the context with verse 1 of Galatians 2. Paul is speaking here where he says, after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas and also took Titus with me. And I went up by a revelation and communicated to them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to those who were of reputation, lest by any means I might run or had run in vain. Yet not even Titus, who was with me, being a Greek, that is a Gentile, was compelled to be circumcised. And this occurred because the false brethren secretly brought in, who came in by stealth to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, that they might bring us into bondage, to whom we did not yield submission, even for an hour, that the truth of the gospel might continue with you. But from those who seemed to be something, whatever they were, it makes no difference to me, God shows personal favoritism to no man. For those who seemed to be something added nothing to me. But on the contrary, when they saw that the gospel for the uncircumcised had been committed to me, as the gospel for the circumcised was to Peter, for he who worked effectively in Peter for the apostleship to the circumcised also worked effectively in me towards the Gentiles. And when James, Cephas, that is Peter, and John, Peter, James, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that had been given to me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. Now, what this is indicating is that after Paul had met with the apostles in Jerusalem, that Peter, James, and John reached an agreement with Peter, or with Paul. They recognized that Paul had been commissioned by the Lord and seemed to have a particular commissioning to emphasize ministry to Gentiles. This did not mean that Paul ministered exclusively to Gentiles. He would always go into any city, first to the synagogue, and seek to present the message of life to Jewish people in the synagogues. Then, once there had been rejection by Jewish people, then he would start concentrating on ministry to Gentiles. And this was his repeated pattern wherever he went. When they see him as having a ministry to the uncircumcised, they're seeing that he was going to be the one who would end up emphasizing ministry to Gentiles. They would emphasize ministry to Jews, but that did not mean that they exclusively ministered to Jews. After all, who was it that first ministered to a Gentile, Peter, with Cornelius, Acts chapters 10 and 11. He is the one who had that initial ministry. I believe that the other apostles did have ministry to Gentiles, but they saw it as they would concentrate on areas where there were, where it was primarily Jewish, whereas Paul would go into areas that had many Gentiles, and much of his ministry was to Gentiles. This was the starting point. There was a recognition by the apostles that each one would have a particular area allocated to them. They were not seeking to be in the same place, duplicate efforts, and essentially end up being in competition with one another. They ended up ministering in different geographic regions, and they had a different primary target audience. This is going to be important. You remember how Paul himself said that he sought to minister in areas where others, that is, other apostles, had not been previously. This ends up being a major feature of how Paul approached things. I think that as we analyze the whole picture, each of the apostles had their areas where they were working, and they would not simultaneously be seeking to minister long term in the same place as where another apostle was. So Galatians 2:9 sets an initial expectation. Now, when one looks at 1 Corinthians 1:12 and 3:22, one sees that Peter had ministry in Antioch, and when that happened, it ended up precipitating the circumstance that made it necessary for there to be a meeting that occurred in Acts chapter 15 that clarified rules of engagement, and that because Peter had inadvertently compromised the message of the gospel by showing favoritism to Jewish people. He always understood, ever since the time of Cornelius, that God had opened the door both to Jews and to Gentiles, but he ended up in a practical way compromising that when he was in Antioch. But Peter had ministered for a period of time in Antioch, and it's also quite clear because of the divisions that occurred within Corinth, where there were people that said that they were of Cephas, that is Cephas or Peter, ones that said that they were of Paul, and others that said they were of Christ. It becomes clear that Peter had ministered in Corinth at one time, not at a time that Paul was there, but he had ministered there. So when we're looking at Antioch and Corinth, those are places where we see both Peter and Paul functioning, but normally at different times. Now, the tradition has assigned John to Ephesus, but John is clearly connected by the book of Revelation to Asia Minor, that is Western Asia Minor, with Ephesus being the first in sequence of the seven churches, which could very well point to it having been John's headquarters. So I don't see anything wrong with what tradition says about where John was. It seems to be well in keeping with what the New Testament sets forth as far as expectations. But let's now think about the writing of the Gospel of John. For that, let's first turn to John chapter 5, verse 2, which might not seem to have much to do with the dating of the Gospel of John, but it is significant. John chapter 5, verse 2 says that there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool which is called in Hebrew Bethesda. Some of your Bibles say things other than Bethesda, but interestingly, there's been a movement towards understanding the reading as Bethesda, in part because of the copper scroll from Qumran, which the Aramaic term that was used clearly for this same pool is giving rise to Bethesda being the correct reading. So even people who favor the Alexandrian manuscripts are moving towards the acceptance of Bethesda as the name here. But the point that we're focused in upon is the word is. It is a present tense. And it does not qualify, it cannot qualify as a historic present. Historic presents are a narrative device where the present tense is used to describe past actions. But please note, past actions. Being verbs are not action verbs. And no one, there are no New Testament scholars that claim that any being verb ever qualifies as being a historic present. Every historic present that's been documented has been an action verb. It is limited to third person verbs, and they all tend to be personal. This is not a personal verb. I was talking about a pool, not a person. It's talking about a pool, and it's a state of being. What John is saying here is at the time of the writing of the Gospel of John, the pool of Bethesda was still there. It was not filled in with debris, and that is exactly what happened when Titus laid siege to Jerusalem. It was not until the late 1800s that the pool was actually located and identified. And it meets all the qualifications. Let me clarify one of the qualifications. It's an important one. The passage here in John 5:2 says that it has five porticos. The reason for that is that it's actually a double pool. The northern pool was the one that was put in first. There was a dam that was there, but then subsequently they added another pool. It was downstream from it, but I butted up against that dam that held the northern pool. So what ended up happening was there was a rectangular portico, four-sided one, that went around the perimeter. But then there was also a portico that went over the dam. That is the reason that it had five porticos. And interestingly, the copper scroll in from Qumran calls it Bethesdain. And what that is indicating is the double pool of Bethesda. Hebrew has a formation that was called the dual. And so, for example, you could speak of a horse. A horse would be sus. If you were talking about a plurality of horses, you would say susim. But if you were talking about a team of horses, a pair of horses, they would say susaim. So Hebrew and Aramaic had not only a plural, but they also had a dual. And the form there at Qumran in describing this pool uses a dual form, the dual pools of Bethesda. Okay, So this requires a date of no later than 70 for the Gospel of John. Interestingly, although Daniel Wallace, professor at Dallas Seminary, often holds, shall we say, less than conservative views, he has become a champion for the case from John 5:2 that there is no way that John wrote after 70. It's a pre-70 book. And Daniel Wallace is a capable grammarian, capable Greek grammarian, and has written what has now become pretty much the standard grammar that people use for New Testament Greek. And he has become quite a champion for the view that John was written before 70. Now, he doesn't date it very far before 70, but I think that there is reason to date it much before that. Something I did not put in the notes, but let's take a look at John chapter 21. And let's look at the next to the last verse of the Gospel of John. John 21, 24. This is the disciple who testifies of these things. In other words, he's saying that the book that he has written, the Gospel of John, is his testimony of what has occurred. And wrote these things. And now it says, and we know that his testimony is true. Who would the we be? Well, liberal scholars who hold to what's called the Johannine school view say that the we is the church that John was ministering at in his old age, and that John has apparently died, and so that church now says, we know that what he's saying is true. Well, John's gospel is heavily focused upon the concept of witness. If you look up the words, Greek words, martus, martyreo, martyria, all the words that relate to testimony, testify, witness, witnessing, a witness, that is a person who testifies. John is very concerned about the rules of evidence. And twice within the book, it comes up that a witness must be someone who has seen it, has seen the event, and also there must be more than one for there to be for that person's testimony to be regarded as credible. On two occasions, Jesus is challenged by people who believe that he's testifying by himself. It does not seem plausible that John's gospel would be claiming John's credibility by people who were not eyewitnesses. There are others that want to say, well, this is just an editorial we, and it's just John speaking for himself. I would argue a different case. John has been joined by fellow apostles who say they know that John's testimony is true. Now, I'd like to back that up. I'd like to back up that that's what's going on here. Let's turn to John chapter 1, verse 14. Now, all this is background for 3 John. Let's not lose sight of that. What we are seeing is the background for which the Gospel of John was written, and the Gospel of John is a book that John had acquainted his readers with. So, knowing something about the chronology of John's Gospel is going to help us understand chronology in relation to the writing of 3 John. Okay, so now as we look at John 1:14, and the Word became flesh and tabernacled, or as it's translated by the New King James, dwelt among us. That word us is quite regularly treated as though it were just people in general. But let's look a little further. Within that verse it says, and we beheld his glory. Glory as of the better handling, the unique one of the Father, full of grace and truth. Let me digress for a moment. I know that the common translation through the years has been only begotten, but one of the things that New Testament scholarship has wrestled with quite a bit over the last number of decades is that the word monogenēs that has been translated only begotten is not spelled the way that the Greek word that would be translated only begotten would be spelled. The word genao, which has to do with procreation, has two N's in it. But this word only has one N. And so it's not related to genao, it's related to genos, a distinct word. Furthermore, Isaac is referred to in the book of Hebrews as Abraham's monogamous son. One would not be able to say he was the only one that was begotten, the only son that was begotten by Abraham. There were other inheritors. When one looks at the children that were born subsequent to the death of Sarah, they were also inheritors, as the text makes clear. They were sons, not just children, they were sons. So the better understanding here is he is the unique one with a unique sonship, full of grace and truth. But notice we beheld him. We apostles. Now let's look at another book that was written by John as reinforcement on this. Let's look at 1 John chapter 1. That which was from the beginning, which we, and the we in the book of 1 John is we apostles. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled concerning the message of life, the life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you. Please note, the we are the ones who declare to you. This is clearly, we is distinct from you. We apostles declare this message to you. Within John's writings, the witnesses are the apostles. Going back to John chapter 21:24, John's fellow apostles know that his testimony is true, and how did they know that? They were there too. Think about the purpose statement of John's gospel. Many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written, these 8 signs, so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He's making very clear that the signs that are included within John's gospel are ones that were done in the presence of his disciples. There were many others that were also done in the presence of his disciples that were not recorded in this book, but the ones that are focused upon are the ones that were attested by John's fellow apostles. They are the ones that put their seal of approval upon here in John 21, 24. They are saying, we absolutely certify that John's message in this book is true. Now, what does that do about the date of the Gospel of John? It requires that there were other apostles that were still alive. So that pushes us well before the dates that people are often wanting for the Gospel of John. This is not a book that was written in the 90s. And actually, if we look at the book of Acts, we find that it wasn't long after the time of Cornelius that the apostles seem to have left, for the most part, Jerusalem, other than James. So, that's pointing towards the Gospel of John being written earlier. My date for John is between 36 and 41. Summarizing the argument for why it has to be this early, John's Gospel does not have any Gentile mission indicated. Everything is pointing towards he is showing the Jewish Messiah to the Jewish people so that they might believe in him. The date, in working through all the arguments, I would say is between 36. 36 is the year that Caiaphas was deposed. He ceased to be the high priest. And the fact that in John's Gospel, on two occasions, it speaks of Caiaphas having been high priest that year. He was high priest during the year that Jesus was crucified. That terminology is not the normal way of referring to someone while they are still in office. That's terminology that would be used after he had left office. So therefore, I would suggest after 36. But before mid-41, which is the latest date possible for Cornelius. There is, in John's Gospel, there are at least 100 footnotes, 100 parentheses, but he never makes the types of clarifications that would be necessary if this book did not mention Gentiles, despite the fact that Jesus had ministry to Gentiles, if it were a book that were written after the year 41, after Cornelius. So, we now have this absence that's spoken of directly, I believe, in 2 John. Well, still somewhat indirectly, but in 2 John, look at verse 12. Having many things to write to you, I did not wish to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come to you and speak face to face, that our joy may be full. His indication here is he is absent. And he plans to go into greater detail when he's present. The points that are brought up in 2 John all also appear in 1 John. And 1 John is arranged around the same outline. So I have inferred from that that 1 John is the expansion as a result of John's absence being extended. Let's now take a look at how 1 John chapter 2 verse 19 may help us out on this. We'll start at verse 18. Little children, it is the last hour. And as you have heard, that the Antichrist is coming. That is, he's yet future. This is what's called a futuristic present, is coming. It's like when we say, I'm going to the grocery store. If I say that to Diane, what I'm saying is, not that I'm on my way right now to the grocery store, but I will do it. I will get there. I will make that stop. And so what he says is Antichrist is coming. This will happen in the future. This is a certain event. But even now, way back in the first century, even now, many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour. How often have you heard people speculating, are we in the last hour? Oh, we've been in the last hour now for about 2,000 years. The last hour was entered the moment of the incarnation. I mean, up until that time, it was awaiting Jesus coming so that the last hour could start. So people speculating on that, it's a meaningless thing to speculate over. But notice, John says that there are people that have followed around with the apostles that he would classify as many of the antichrists with a small a. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out that they might be made manifest, that none of them were of us. Now he's not talking about geographic issues. The apostles had spread out. They're not all still in Jerusalem. They've gone out. What he's talking about leaving us is they've left the teaching. They've moved into false teaching. And the fact that they are not continuing in the same doctrine is the issue that shows that they have gone out away from apostolic doctrine. That's what he's talking about. Now, this, John says, which is again an indication that he's talking to someone here, as he's writing to a church, to the leadership of a church, I would argue, that he's not in their immediate presence. It seems that John has been gone for a period of time. Now, the epistles seem to be written in the 60s. The Gospel of John was written prior to that. We have Paul telling us, or Luke telling us in the book of Acts, that Paul was at one point forbidden from entering into Asia. I believe that that was at a point when John the Apostle was in Asia. By the way, when I say Asia, or when the New Testament says Asia, it's talking about a province in Western Turkey. It's not talking about the continent of Asia. It's not even talking about all of Asia Minor, but it's talking about a province that included Ephesus. The fact that Paul was forbidden from going there and then was directed to go across, go into Macedonia, go into Europe, something that the apostles, none of them had done that up to that point, may be a strong indication that John the Apostle was present. But then let's think about it. Within the timeline of Paul's ministry, lo and behold, he ministers in Ephesus. And he was there for a long time. I would argue that the period of time that Paul was ministering in Ephesus was a period of time that John the Apostle was absent. That would fit with John perhaps going back to Jerusalem. Okay, so within this picture, we have reason to believe that John has been absent. Yes, we're having to fill in a few blanks. We don't have the text telling us explicitly when John was present in Asia Minor, when he was absent, but we do have indications of Paul being not allowed to enter, but then Paul entering. Then we have indications of John being absent, needing to write letters, and there being hints that he's been away for an extended period of time. Problems have developed. I would argue that at the time that John is writing these letters, neither he nor Paul were in Ephesus. If Paul were there, Paul would have been able to address the problems. If John were there, he would be able to address the problems without writing a letter. So this is pointing in the direction of a period of time that both John and Paul were absent from Asia Minor. Just for completeness, I mention here that my dating for the book of Revelation is 71-72. That's an unusual view, but I believe that a letter that Vespasian wrote to Domitian in 72 would give a pretty strong indication that, as far as I'm concerned, makes 71-72 to be a very good date for the book of Revelation. So it has to be prior to that, has to be obviously during John's lifetime, but we don't have a date when he died. And the traditional or the common dating of the book of Revelation as being in the 90s really doesn't give clear indication, because they're working from assumptions on the date of Revelation rather than working from any hard data and when John actually died. John had to have been alive. I think it's a safe feature that works for this to be during the 60s, at a period of time when neither Paul nor John were in Asia Minor. Clearly, the fact that Paul had imprisonment in Caesarea for approximately 2 years and also had imprisonment in Rome for 2 years means that there is a considerable period of time that John and Paul would have both been absent. So with that, now let's move into consideration of the contents of this book, having given plausibility to the view that this is a book written during a time that both John and Paul were absent from Asia Minor. So in verses 2 through 4, we have a commendation of Gaius. This has two parts to it. We have in verse 2 John's prayer for Gaius, and then we will have in verses 3 and 4 the reason for his prayer. So in verse 2, he says, "Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health just as your soul prospers." Now this is a remarkable statement. He wants him to be as healthy physically as he is spiritually. You know, for a lot of people, it would be quite a curse to say, "May your health be as good physically as it is spiritually." But you know, this is quite a commendation of Gaius. John, I would argue, has a considerable background with him. So although he's writing in a way that as we look at some of the verses, it's clear indication that he's been apart from him for a period of time. There has been enough contact, perhaps directly as well as indirectly through emissaries that have gone out, these emissaries that are ministering, that are traveling and doing ministry. John is receiving reports, and John is probably in regular contact with him. He knows that he's doing well. Let me give a little indication here on this letter. This will help to clarify a little bit about who Gaius is. Gaius has connection with whichever one of the churches, very possibly Ephesus, that John is very concerned about, and that has given rise to the book of 1 John. Gaius has a connection with it, and let me give that indication. Look at verse 9. "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them," and I would take it preeminence among the elders, "does not receive us." So what he's saying is that particular letter that he sent to Diotrephes, he has no reason to believe that that letter is still intact or is still available for anyone else to read. Diotrephes may have received it and confiscated it. So what he's doing is he's writing to Gaius, who has an association with that church, but is not on the elder board, and that, so it's a separate channel in which he's explaining to him some of what his plans are as to how he's going to deal with Gaius. So we have clear indications there are problems going on at the church that are needing to be dealt with. He wants for Gaius to have a heads up. He's written a letter to the church, but that letter may have already been destroyed. So Gaius is an important person here within the whole picture, and Gaius is one that John has great trust of and is certain that he is doing well in his walk with the Lord. He has his doctrinal head screwed on, and John is not at all concerned about his loyalties moving away from the text. And he's praying that he will do as well physically as he is doing spiritually. And so now in verses 3 and 4, the 4 gives indication that he's going to give an explanation of why he has this particular prayer for him. "For I rejoiced greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Now, let me reconstruct this. Diotrephes, as we're going to see when we get into this the next time we talk about 3 John, refuses all of the emissaries that John has sent. John sends emissaries just like Paul did. Paul's team, that, you know, this person goes here, this person goes there, and so forth. These are emissaries being sent out by the apostles who are carrying letters and who have messages to share with church. And lo and behold, Diotrephes will have nothing to do with this emissary that has come from John. But the emissary is well received by Gaius. And this is how John has up-to-date information about Gaius, because Gaius has received the emissary, has put him up as far as a place to stay, has accommodated him and taken care of him, and is on the same page doctrinally as John. And so John knows that Gaius is loyal. He's loyal to the word, and he's doing things that are putting him at odds with Diotrephes. He's putting himself in what would be an uncomfortable position. And John is wanting to let him know that he's not been abandoned. That although the emissary has been turned away and it looks like Diotrephes is running the whole show, John wants to let him know, I appreciate what you've done, and this is not the end of the matter. I am going to deal with Diotrephes, but I certainly want to let you know that I'm aware of your circumstances, and I have rejoiced greatly when the brethren, the emissaries, have returned, and they've told me that of your stand for the truth that you are taking at great personal cost. And I have no greater joy than to hear of that my children walk in truth. Now do notice, this is giving us indication by the terminology that he uses. He calls Gaius one of his children. He's indicating that he had a role in Gaius coming to believe. When John was in Asia Minor, Gaius was one of the people that he ministered to. So this is why I say he has great personal knowledge of him, but there's been a period of time that they have not had direct contact. But Gaius is giving indication. He's standing with the truth, and he's willing to do so even at great personal cost. So, John has an encouragement for Gaius. He has something he wants him to do. So in verses 5 through 8, he encourages Gaius to continue supporting those who proclaim the truth. The people he's talking about, in many cases, are going to be emissaries sent by John himself. Something is going to happen in order to keep this church from degrading into false teaching. At this point, there is no indication that Diotrephes himself is teaching falsehood, but it does seem the power has gone to his head. We'll talk about that more when we get into the further sections of this passage, but here in verses 5 through 8, he's encouraging him to continue doing what he has been doing of supporting those who proclaim truth. And so there are brethren that testify to Gaius's hospitality to traveling preachers of truth, ones that I believe are emissaries sent by John himself. Verses 5 through 6a. Beloved, notice this is the second time that he has referred to him that way. He will again refer to him in the same way in verse 11. You do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. So, all of the things that he's done, John is giving, extending appreciation for that, saying that they have been done faithfully. And these have been done for brethren and for strangers. Now, the brethren and strangers are believers because they are ones who bear witness of your love before the church. These are ones that are, as he says, he calls in verse 8, fellow workers for the truth. John does not use the term fellow worker for the truth lightly, nor does Paul. These are people who are ministering the word of God, probably emissaries sent by John himself. In verse 6b, he tells him that his hospitality towards these traveling preachers of truth is rewardable. Notice he says, if you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well. He said that Gaius has already done that. That's the indication that's given here within these words. He's saying, continue to do what you have done. And why is it that this would be rewardable? Verse 7. He says, because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. Now, since the focus of John's ministry is upon Jews, it doesn't mean that John refused to minister to Gentiles, but he positioned himself so that the people to whom he was ministering were very heavily going to be Jewish people. If someone within that context were looking for financial support from Gentiles, it would be from Gentile unbelievers. So he's not saying that it's wrong to receive financial support from Gentile believers, but he's saying these are ones who were ministering primarily among Jewish people, and they were not accepting money from Gentile unbelievers. And so they're not taking a shortcut to make their financial situation easier. They are ministering appropriately, and they are letting God be the one who is providing for their sustenance, rather than reaching out and trying to raise money in ways that would have them dependent upon unbelievers. And there's an inference. Believers ought to be hospitable to traveling preachers of truth in order to share in their reward. Notice, we therefore, in light of this, ought to emulate them. But we also ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth. And the receiving is going to focus upon receiving their word, but also receiving them in such a way that they're able to be helped along the way, put up while they're ministering in one's geographic area, feeding them, so on and so forth, making it so that they can function and continue their ministry and not find themselves destitute because what they are doing is depending upon God's people for their support. So all of this is written to encourage a believer who has stood for the truth and has done so at personal expense, where he has helped along ones who have been emissaries sent out by John, and John is encouraging him to continue doing that and is indicating the position of becoming a fellow worker. A fellow worker is going to be someone who is going to share in that person's reward. Because what is happening is they are contributing to that ministry having the success that God would want. God raises among God's people support for his ministries. And John is saying, you, Gaius, have an opportunity to continue to participate in that way, and I urge you to do so. So this is the happy part of the letter. As we conclude it on the next time in January, it will be getting into the tougher part of this message. But all of this is laying a foundation for a consideration of 1 John. All the way through, John treats it as a known quantity. God's people are ones that know that they have believed Jesus for everlasting life, and so therefore they know that they have everlasting life. That's foundational in these two epistles. It's also foundational in 1 John. Though unfortunately, so much of the teaching on 1 John imagines that people are needing to keep the commands of the book in order to assure themselves that they possess everlasting life, and that if they fall short, that thereby they prove that they were not believers in the first place. What an awful mess that people have foisted onto that book. Just understanding the chronology of these books is a major help in showing that the certainty that is exuded in 2nd and 3rd John is an underlying feature of 1st John and must not be denied in one's handling of the interpretation of that book.